The next case on this panel's oral argument calendar this morning is Dr. Shara Bradley versus the 8th Judicial District Court and Real Parties in Interest, Dante Hudson et al., case number 70522. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
May I?
Yes, of course.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is a very important issue and appears to be a case of first impression before this court. And that is whether or not the treatment records that were promulgated during a mental health therapeutic session are discoverable pursuant to a general discovery request and then order, when those records are not within the possession of the state, when those records promulgated by Dr. Bradley, the psychologist treating a child, is not a witness in the state.
Counsel, could you clarify one thing for me before you get into the meat of your argument? My understanding is that there were two orders here, one that was rather broad and one that was narrowed. Is that right?
I think the one that I acted...
What's that issue in this appeal? I just want to make sure I understand the scope of the order or orders that are issued in this appeal.
The scope of the order in
this writ.
Yes, I think that the first order was more of a generalized order, the way I understand it. I became involved in this case when there was a motion to hold Dr. Bradley in contempt because she had not responded to that particular order. Subsequently, I believe there was an order for in-camera review. However, in signing that order, which I believe was just a form order prepared by the defense counsel, that order had no findings. There was no evidentiary hearing whatsoever. There was just no basis for in-camera review, especially when we were dealing with a third party and those records were not within the custody or control of the state of Nevada. The records were never intended to be used by the state of Nevada. They were court-ordered, I believe, under Nevada statute annotated 62C 240, which is for alleged victims in human trafficking cases to be allowed treatment for mental health, among other things. And I believe I did file at 7 o'clock this morning a notice of supplemental authority. I recognize that it's absolutely untimely. It's just that I learned of this case last night. It's the AJ versus state case. It's not on point with this case, except to the extent that this panel recognized the need for treatment under Nevada law, mental health treatment in particular, for alleged victims of human trafficking, which brings us to a point that I believe I'll make later. But, Your Honor, did I answer your question?
Well, not exactly. My understanding is that on January 1st or thereabouts, the district court entered an order requiring that the complete juvenile and delinquency file related to JA, including but not limited to all records from Child Protective Services, the Department of Child and Family Services, an entire juvenile delinquency file, including detention records, be provided to the district court. On February 9th, the district court entered an amended order requiring that any and all records for any counseling services provided by Dr. Shara Bradley be provided to the district court after JA's arrest in February 2015. And then I understood that that was the order that you are contesting here.
It's the only order that we're contesting, yes.
Right.
As to those records of Dr. Bradley, it's my understanding, and based upon the briefing by defendant Hudson, that a lot of records were already received by him concerning the juvenile custody records and other juvenile delinquency records with respect to this victim. Now, we're solely concerned with the narrow issue of counseling treatment records that were made between this psychologist, Dr. Bradley, and then an alleged victim of human trafficking, who is a minor. The reason why we request that you grant our petition, which we submit, is within your discretion entirely. This is not a discovery dispute. This goes to the core of a privilege that has years and years of public policy and societal interests that have developed. All states have it. Nevada, of course, has recognized the psychotherapy privilege. The Supreme Court of the United States has recognized it in the seminal case of Jaffe versus Redmond. The bases for this particular privilege are profound, and that is confidentiality. Confidentiality and trust between the psychotherapist and her patient are transcendent, and there can be no breach other than for the most of compelling reasons.
Well, it does seem to be quite a bit of authority that suggests that during the trial, at least, this privilege might be subject to an exception to accommodate the Confrontation Clause privileges of the defendant, Confrontation Clause rights, I should say. If that's true, why shouldn't the trial judge at least be allowed to review this material in camera and hold on any decision until the subject is at a point during the trial where it may or may not be introduced under that authority?
Here's why, Your Honor. An uncertain privilege, which pretrial and camera review would necessarily create, an uncertain privilege that's subject to so many different and varying decisions, is not a privilege at all. And so pretrial, where there is no compelling basis other than the Sixth Amendment and 14th Amendment, let me look at it, or let a judge look at it, that is not a compelling reason to create that uncertainty. Again.
Well let's suppose I get the broader problem or the problem with the broader request, but not unlike the first case we just argued this morning, where the attorney's privilege is as sacrosanct, I am sure you would suggest, as the psychotherapy privilege is.
Yes, Your Honor.
In both instances, there's a request now to invade that privilege in order to develop information for use at a criminal trial. So if we are going to give some consideration to invading the attorney-client privilege, at least for the development of material that might be used in a criminal trial, why shouldn't we allow the judge to conduct an in-camera review of psychotherapy information where the request isn't, I just want to look at it, the request is much more specific. Mr. Hudson wants to look at communications that he might use to offer in cross-examination of your client's client.
Your Honor, again, I don't think that it should be allowed pretrial at all. Cases resolve, as the court well knows. It would create this uncertainty. While Judge Herndon may allow in-camera review, again, without any evidentiary hearing or basis provided by the defendant other than I want to look, while he may allow it, Judge Susan Johnson may not. Judge Eric Johnson may say, no, I'm not going to look at it or order in-camera review until after the witness has testified, consistent with Alaska v. Davis and the Hammond Court, which I believe the court, Your Honor, is referencing. And Hammond is a very important case, I think, for this court to consider in fashioning its rule with respect to any sacrosanct privilege, such as attorney-client or especially therapy. And that is, it shouldn't be allowed pretrial. Again, because of the uncertainty, the unpredictability, the disparity among decisions. Let's go back to Nevada statute annotated 62C through 40, mm-hmm. that this court is very familiar with. All right, in there, Nevada, Las Vegas in particular, ranks 13th in the country in human trafficking. And these human trafficking victims are allowed mental health treatment. Now, if these victims happen to be witnesses in human trafficking cases, that means defense attorneys are going to file requests for in-camera review of every single one of these kids. Do you think a kid knowing that, especially in this kind of community of human trafficking, do you think a kid is going to subject herself or comply with treatment knowing that there is just the chance that a judge, this kid does not know?
Excuse me. I'm sorry. Just to inquire, so I'm sure that I understand the procedural history. You didn't get a subpoena for this. No subpoena was sent for this information. Isn't that correct?
No. The first that we knew about it, because, of course, Dr. Bradley is a party, and she's not within the custody or control of the state, was that there was a fax sent to an old office of hers with a motion to hold her in contempt. And so that's when she engaged me. And don't get me wrong, Your Honors, I represent criminal defendants too. I've been court appointed to represent witnesses. You think that the court would order me to turn over my records with a human trafficking witness? No. Not for in-camera review pretrial. That one actually shocks the conscience. It should also shock the conscience to turn over treatment records when we all know that it's for the good of society that we have a mentally healthy society. And that policy has been underscored over and over again. If the court is inclined to find that there may be, in a hypothetical case, this is not the one, but there may be in a hypothetical case, a basis, a compelling basis to order in-camera review, I respectfully request that you make the guidelines for the judges that would be ordering such review clear and concise so that there can be some predictability as to these decisions.
Isn't there a need for similar guidelines even during trial, and if so, what would you suggest they be? What should the standard be? How would you articulate it if you were writing the opinion?
Let's
assume that the court agreed with your position that these matters should not be released even by in-camera review pretrial, that during the course of the trial some evidence develops that warrants at least this discussion. What should be the standard that the district courts use before allowing access and review?
I submit that the court should look to the Abbott decision and Kirshner line of cases. Now, those are for a witness where the state does have possession of records and probably is going to call a psychiatrist or a psychologist to present evidence, and the defendant must show a compelling need to examine that child or witness, okay?
I'm glad you raised that point, because one of the concerns I had in the case is the relationship between Dr. Bradley and the state. If you were dealing with a independent private practitioner, maybe the analysis might be different than if you were dealing with someone who is employed by the state.
Your Honor, as a court-appointed attorney, I'm employed by the state. Dr. Bradley has a contract with the state. So do so many psychologists. If I have an indigent client and I go employ a psychologist who's going to be paid by the state, it's the same thing. a lot of the allegations about the relationship between Dr. Bradley and the state are just that. It's argument. It's very zealous, beautiful argument, but that's all it is. Because...
So in your view, she is a contractor like any other contractor.
Has a special relationship with a child and has duties to that child who is her patient.
She's not an employee. She didn't get a W-2.
I don't know if she got a W-2 or not.
Nothing in the record about this.
There's no record about that.
Okay. All right. I will give you a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, Your Honor.
You'll have 17 minutes, Ms. Conley.
Hey, please, the court. Karen Conley appearing on behalf of the Real Party and Interest, Dante Haslam's counsel. In this particular case, the district court did not abuse its discretion in ordering that the therapy records of Dr. Cheryl Bradley should be released to the court for an in-camera review.
But what was the showing, Ms. Connolly? What was the showing Mr. Hudson made? What did he intend to find in the records? What was the showing to the court to justify even having an in-camera review?
Well, at the time that the motion was filed, the court did have in its possession a copy of the preliminary hearing transcript. During the preliminary hearing, AJ, and to the majority of the questions that I requested of her, her questions were, I don't recall, her answers, sorry, I don't recall, I don't know, I don't recall. The only questions to which she could provide a definitive response were questions which inculpated Mr. Hudson. Any questions in regard to what did Mr. Hudson say, what did Mr. Hudson do, she was able to provide a response. Every other question was, I don't know, I don't know. Also, but
can you give us an example of those types of questions so we have a basis of understanding? What are you talking about?
She was asked, when did you talk to the detective? I don't know. Do you talk to the detective at home or at juvenile detention center? I don't know. Do you know how many days of school you missed February, which was the month of the incident? I don't know.
But why would you believe that information? Was it a belief that information would be in her psych therapy file?
Well, you were asking me what information was before the court, so that was one of the things that were before the court. So one of the issues that the court was aware of was that there was problems with the credibility of this young lady. The other thing the court was aware of, that this young lady was on juvenile probation. And what I had requested was a release of her juvenile file and encompassing therein any of the psychological records that were encapsulated in that juvenile file. This young lady...
But these records were not in the juvenile file. They were in Dr. Bradley's office. Only the fact her participation in therapy was reflected in the juvenile file. Isn't that correct?
Well, no. In the juvenile file, it was... Yeah, I don't have all of the records, so I'm not privy to exactly what was provided because Judge Herndon, after reviewing the records which were forwarded to him, determined which records should be provided to me, and I reviewed those. So I don't know the whole scope of exactly what was provided to him. However, it was determined that this young lady was ordered by the juvenile court to get treatment with Ms. Bradley. It's also, and I think it's very compelling in this particular case, that this is not an unlimited privilege. This is a privilege that has been waived. Because during the juvenile proceedings, not only does she engage in counseling with Ms. Bradley, but there's also what's called CFT meetings. These meetings involve the juvenile, her mother, her counselor, her therapist, or probation officer, where they all sit down and discuss what's going on with this young lady, including her counseling. And I provided the court my supplemental exhibits, the document that I had showing that there was a CFT. I also provided the court with exhibits indicating that if she doesn't comply with what she's told to do, if she doesn't treat with Dr. Bradley, then she's brought back before the court.
So that goes to the fact of treatment, not necessarily the content of the treatment, correct? I mean, if she goes to therapy, she's ordered to go to therapy. And if she doesn't go to therapy, then there could be a repercussion. But that goes to the fact of therapy. The court doesn't crack into the counseling file to find out what's being spoken about at the therapy.
Well, I don't have all of those records, so I'm kind of arguing just based upon what's being disclosed to me. It's my understanding, I think it's notably, that they didn't address in any of their pleadings whether or not that privilege had been waived. And I also pointed...
Isn't the privilege, though, in that same vein, isn't the privilege broad enough to encompass people who may be necessary for some particular sessions? Parent, for instance, or a guardian to be present at the time, if that's part of the therapy and doesn't necessarily waive it?
Well, I think parents and guardians are one thing. However, officers of the court and the juvenile court judge and a probation officer, And there's case law that indicates that under Mitchell versus 8th Judicial District Court, that once that privilege is waived, it's waived.
I guess that's what I'm struggling with. My understanding of this record is that their interaction was simply to make sure she was complying with the treatment program, as opposed to, as Justice Stiglitz indicated, any disclosure of any treatment whatsoever.
Again, because I don't have everything, I've just got, and I think that's why an in-camera view is appropriate, because the judge gets to review the file to determine, is there anything in here that Mr. Hudson is entitled to? Is there anything exculpatory?
But isn't it incumbent upon Mr. Hudson to make a showing rather than just a generalized fishing expedition into these privileged records?
Well, and at the time that the request was made, and I made the request, the judge granted my request. He didn't request any additional information from me. If he'd requested that, then I
would. In your request, what did you argue? Did you say, we have these statements, or we suspect this information about J.A., and we want to look at these counseling files to see what's been said or done about that? Is that what was said to the judge, or did you just say, we want all these juvenile records as part of our discovery in the criminal case?
No, I requested, pursuant to stamps, a copy of the entire juvenile file, because those records have been reviewed, I believe, already by the juvenile court judge.
Is there any evidence that Ms. Bradley's reports were part of the juvenile file? Because if they were, you didn't need to involve Ms. Bradley. You could have just gotten them from the juvenile court. So we're talking about separate records.
Well, again, I think that's why it's incumbent for the district judge. I don't get these records. Mr. Hudson doesn't get these records. It's the district court judge that gets to review them and to determine, has this young lady made statements?
Judge Stiglitz is... point. Judge Hernan doesn't know Dr. Bradley unless he's told about Dr. Bradley. So Dr. Bradley must have been brought to his attention by you in your motion.
Well, in the motion, the request is for her juvenile records, and encompassed in those juvenile records are the counseling records. That's part and parcel of her probation. And I think it's also important that Dr. Bradley, as one of your honors brought out when questioning Ms. Bliss, she's a part of the human trafficking task force. She's not an independent psychologist that this young lady went out and obtained treatment unrelated to her probation or my client's case. Dr. Bradley was with her during her preliminary hearing. I moved for her to be excluded, and my request was denied. And if you look at her CV, she's deeply involved in the human trafficking task force. And I think it's extremely troubling that she's a part of this human trafficking task force. She obviously has an agenda, yet she is in the mind of this young lady, who is the only witness against my client, who is facing a life sentence if he's convicted. And what the Jaffe case talks about, and what Pennsylvania versus Ritchie talk about, is a balancing of the interest of the defendant, his right to due process and confrontation, and the right of the victim, or the young lady in this case, to privacy. And when we look at her privacy, the fact that she must have been notified by her counsel, because pursuant to the American Psychological Association rules and regulations, she has to have notified her client that since this is court ordered, I may be forced to divulge some of the contents of our discussions. So back to my point, she's a part of this task force. So this young lady is arrested, she's taken to juvenile court, she's placed on probation, she's told you must go to Dr. Bradley, and then Dr. Bradley is giving her psychological treatment prior to her coming in and testifying.
That's the point I'm struggling with as well. From a policy standpoint, isn't it extremely dangerous for us to go down that path and invade this psychiatrist-patient privilege? And what chilling effect would that have, especially when you have victims of this nature? From a policy standpoint, tell me why I'm wrong, or why the state's wrong.
Well, from a policy standpoint, because this young lady was ordered to go meet with Dr. Bradley, it was incumbent upon her to notify this young lady that the privilege, there's a limited privilege, that everything that she says to Dr. Bradley is not confidential, Because it's court ordered.
What authority do you have that the court, in this instance, just because he orders somebody to counseling, that the court, I think I've seen that in the context of drug alcohol programs when somebody's in a drug court, and sometimes they sign waivers to that. What was the belief of this young lady that her meeting her forced therapy would be disclosed, subject to disclosure? Where's that in the record?
In the supplemental authorities I provided, I cited Rule 3.10, Rule 4.02, and Rule 10.01 of the American Psychological Association Ethical Principles of Psychologists and Code of Conduct, which indicate that if it's court-ordered, the therapist has an obligation to notify the child. I'm not answering your question.
I appreciate that, but only if it's required that Dr. Bradley disclose this information to the court, and I don't see that here. Just because she's ordered to counseling doesn't mean that the court gets to crack into it.
Well, I think we can know that from as a result of their failure to address it in any of the pleadings they filed with this court. Because in my answer to the writ, I specifically put in there that it was my understanding, placed on the records that I have, that this information was divulged to third parties, that it was divulged to the court, that it was divulged to the probation officer, that it was divulged to other parties.
The actual treatment was?
I allege that, and they deny that. They did not deny that in anything.
They did. I think they came back and stated what was for the purpose of demonstrating compliance with the order of treatment.
Well, I don't recollect because them seeing specifically that the content of the therapy was not disclosed, and I believe it is, because as I indicated, they have these CFT meetings where everybody sits down and has a discussion about what's going on and what's the next step we should take with this young lady. Should we let her off probation? Does she need additional counseling services?
The CFT is independent, though, of the individualized sessions that this young lady is having with Dr. Bradley. So even if you have some argument that the CFT somehow, the contents of that CFT are subject to disclosure or have been disclosed, you could pursue that without breaking into the therapy records of Dr. Bradley. Isn't that correct?
I don't get to see the records. The judge, the order was for an in-camera review, and I think that's important because I don't know what all is in there.
But that's the point. What do you even think is in there? It's just, are you saying to find out what might be something helpful in there? Is there anything grounded in the evidence that you can point to that you can suggest to this court would give us those type of exceptional need to crack into a privilege like this?
Well, I think it's also significant that the state has indicated that it's bringing in an expert in, for lack of a better term, the pimp and prostitute culture. And this, the court has indicated that when the behavioral and psychological characteristics are issued by the state bringing in an expert to say, well, you know, she didn't remember anything she said at the preliminary hearing, but that's consistent with these young ladies who are pimped out by their man. By these men, that's a cycle of abuse. They're bringing in an expert. They're bringing in a specific expert at trial to talk about. And this court has said that when the state's going to do that, that's why we have the...
But isn't that generalized expert information? Under your theory, if the state brings in a battered women's syndrome expert, then you could crack into any domestic violence victim's therapy? They had therapy somewhere else. Are you saying the state puts your individual therapy an issue if they put on that type of expert?
Well, I think if the state's going to say that this person acted in a certain way, which is consistent with people who, you know, are battered and she exhibited these behaviors, therefore he must have battered her because it's consistent, and there's records that perhaps her behaviors weren't consistent and she had a mental health expert who is working with the prosecution. Dr. Bradley is working with the prosecution, with the detectives, everybody, all these, it's an entire group of people. And I think it's very important that she's not a neutral person.
Is there any information grounded in evidence in the record that Dr. Bradley disclosed any of her therapy sessions with the prosecutor?
Oh, I doubt she, I don't, the
or
prosecutor, no. But again, there's a juvenile court proceeding, and I feel confident that in those CFTs and the meetings, the family meetings and the therapy meetings and the social worker meetings and the probation officer meetings they have with the young lady when she's on juvenile probation, that her progress in therapy is discussed. And
did you talk to any? I'm sorry.
The judge got those records apparently, and he didn't release them to you.
I don't know what the district court judge has. I'm very limited.
But at least he hasn't released those CFT sessions.
Well, I got, and what's interesting is I found significant information in the juvenile records that I've gotten already, which I didn't know before. And again, I think it's very, and I understand that human trafficking is a big problem, and they've developed this task force, but it doesn't mean that they should be able to trample all over, you know, the suspect's rights. And in this particular case, they have this entire group of people. And I think...
Where is there evidence in the record, in this record in front of us, that Dr. Bradley is a so-called agent, you say working with, an agent of the prosecution and part of some sex trafficking strike force?
All in her CV that she provided. Her CV, she talks about, there's pages and pages of her involvement in the human trafficking task force. And the point I wanted to make...
Let's stick to this case.
She hasn't denied that. But again, I think a lot of what I'm saying is based upon omission, their failure to refute allegations.
Did she testify in this hearing?
Is she what?
Did she testify before the order of the in-camera inspection?
Well, it was a very, very brief hearing, and it was the state prosecutor and myself.
That's what I'm arguing. Part of my difficulty here is, the record here is he entered an order. It was pretty broad, and then it got amended and it got specific as to Dr. Bradley, but I don't see anybody's affidavit, declarations, nothing that we would normally expect, even in criminal discovery, to form a basis for invading privileges.
And again, I don't know what Judge Herndon specifically has reviewed. I don't know which of her records.
So let me return to a question I posed to your opponent earlier. There does seem to be some authority in limited circumstances to grant an exception to the psychologist privilege during trial. But I don't find any cases, and I don't think there's been any cited, that allows for it pre-trial.
Well, I think
that's true.
No, I would disagree. I think in the Jaffe case they cited in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie, what takes place is a balancing of the interests of both parties, and I think that has to happen pre-trial. As defense counsel, I need to know what I'm coming up against trial. It also is imperative that I know all the evidence in preparation and in determining whether or not to negotiate a case or go to trial. What we're interested in is if there's statements that have been made. The judge is reviewing it to see if there's exculpatory information only. If there's no exculpatory information, then I don't get it. I never see it. So in terms of them saying it's having a chilling effect on the treatment of the child, as I indicated, she's already compelled to tell this young lady that there's a limited privilege because it's ordered by the court.
All right. Any other questions by the panel members? All right. Thank you, Ms. Connor.
Very quickly, Your Honor, as far as getting a waiver, that's consistent with the Tarasoff case, which was a California Supreme Court case where, like we attorneys, psychologists, psychiatrists have a duty to breach the privilege if they believe someone's life is in danger. That's what that is about. I don't know where counsel came up with this idea that it's a waiver for a criminal defense attorney to get the confidential communications.
I'm really disturbed about that myself. I mean, under Chapter 62 proceedings, I would think that these CRTs would be confidential. I mean, if you're going to engage, set aside the argument, policy arguments you've made about sex trafficking with young girls, let's just take juveniles in general. If they're going through treatment and therapy sessions, I'm concerned that those sessions would constitute a waiver for frank and communications and could be accessed in criminal defense cases without any kind of restriction or restraint. That troubles me.
Well, let me parse a little bit. As far as the records that were obtained by subpoena by defense counsel, the treatment records were not disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
Team meetings, they're multi-task forces, concern educational issues, physical health, as well as they can engage mental health providers. It's a team approach, but that doesn't mean that secrets are divulged by anyone who is under a privilege. Those records were not divulged. And being on a task force is not a waiver. And furthermore, we did address the fact that there's no basis whatsoever to suggest a waiver. That's in our reply brief at page 7 through 8. Last thing I know, Your Honor, before you bring the hook out, is Jaffe. Jaffe does not suggest a balancing test. I would point the court to page 17 of that decision. In fact, Jaffe rejects a balancing test for the very reasons that we started out with here, uncertainty, and undermining the societal and public policy interests of rattling and essentially disarming a privilege that's so sacred to us.
All right, thank you, Ms. Bliss. Ms. Connolly, we appreciate your excellent arguments and briefing in a challenging case. Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 11.